Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Tomorrow we're going to do 2 hours of open forum for non-Catholics. So if you are non-Catholic and you can't call today, because non-Catholics are welcome every day, but some days we just hold those lines for non-Catholics so you can call and ask your questions about the Catholic faith. Today, a full hour of open forum that is open to every single human being on earth. That's 7 and some change billion people. So, yeah, and you're one of those. So go ahead and dial 888-318-7884 if you have a question. Your questions are welcome on a whole broad range of things. Certainly any question having to do with faith, with the religious life in general, with the moral life, with the teachings of Christianity, with the person of Jesus, all welcome. But Jimmy's open to just about anything, as you could tell, because he answered a question on the Big Bang a little while ago. 888-318-7884 is the number. Jimmy, you ready to get right back into it?
Oh, sure.
All right, let's go to Pam in Mansfield, Ohio, who's been watching on Facebook. Pam, you there with us?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, I just got to tell you something. I see from your question, Jimmy wasn't here yesterday. So if you want to, I know you wanted to.
Oh, okay. Well, yesterday someone had called in and asked about marital, like, couples.
Are you still married? When you're in heaven. Are you still married? Yeah.
Yes, and I understand that concept quite well. What I was hoping he could expound upon is other people in the family that we have. For instance, people who have deeply hurt you. I have a narcissistic parent who I have had to deal with quite a bit with different issues here. So when I go on to heaven, will those issues... will I still know of them, or will they be erased? I don't know. Can you explain that to me, please?
Well, we don't have any evidence that we'll know less about things in the future. The information we have from, for example, the Gospels indicates that we'll actually know more in the next life than we know in this one. And so I wouldn't expect to forget what happened, but I also would not expect for it to hurt anymore, because one of the things that the Bible teaches, and if you want to look this up, you can find it near the top of chapter 21 in the book of Revelation, is that everyone who enters the heavenly city, New Jerusalem, is freed from suffering. And John points out that there will not be crying or pain or tears anymore because the old order of things will have passed away. And so even though we may be aware of things that happen to us in our lifetimes that were painful at the time, they will not be painful to us in heaven. And so we don't need to be afraid of that. We don't need to worry about that. And if our loved one is with us in heaven, even or our family member is with us in heaven, they're going to be transformed just like we're going to be transformed. So we're not going to have the flaws in heaven that we have right now. God is going to heal us. He's going to enable us to become fully loving the way Jesus is fully loving. That's part of what it means to say that we're going to be transformed to be like Jesus. We're going to be as loving as he is. And so if you have a narcissistic parent, here's hoping the narcissistic parent makes it to heaven. And in that process of going to heaven, it may involve a stop in purgatory, but God will heal your parent so that the parent is no longer narcissistic. And so the parent is fully loving. And as part of purgatory, the parent would realize just how bad their actions were and just how badly they impacted other people, and would feel sorry for that and would repent of that and regret that. And so that would enable, if you both make it to heaven, a reconciliation to be possible that might not have been possible in this life. But at that point, there will be no more pain, there will be no more tears, there will be no more crying, and there will be abundant love from everyone.
Okay, Pam.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for starting us off, Pam. The number is 888-318-7884. It's open forum. Up next is Zach in Dallas, Texas, watching on YouTube. Hi, Zach.
Hi.
Got a question for Jimmy?
Yes. So if there's time, I had two hopefully quick questions. And the first one would be in Genesis, when it says, let me pull this up. It says, God took Enoch to himself and he was seen no more. That's Genesis 5:24. What does that mean? Does it mean he went up into heaven or he was set apart? Because it seems like he didn't die but was taken.
Yeah, and it's made clear in other books of Scripture. We get a little more information about this. A more literal translation is Enoch walked with God and he was not, for God took him. And people have discussed possibilities about what that might mean. One of the things we know for sure is it means he didn't die, because the book of Hebrews tells us that. If you look in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, it gives us a little bit more information about Enoch, including the fact he didn't die. And the translation will vary. In some translations, it will say that Enoch was translated, and what that means is open to some interpretation. In other translations, it will say Enoch was taken up, which would suggest he went to heaven. If you look in the book of Sirach, in chapter 44 and also in chapter 49, it has a little bit of information about Enoch. And in one of those chapters, in chapter 49, it says that he was taken up from the earth. At least that's what it says in the translation that I've looked at most recently. I haven't been able to check the Greek. I haven't had the opportunity to do that to see, does it specifically say in Greek he was taken up from the earth, which would, again, point to him going to heaven, even though it's before the time of Christ. It would be another early exception, because God is God, and he can make exceptions if he chooses. We do have evidence of another exception that's at least similar to this, where God takes the prophet Elijah to heaven, and there it's clear that he goes to heaven, because it uses the Hebrew word for heaven, Shemayim. So it says Elijah got taken to Shemayim, or to heaven, and that would be another exception, because God is God and he can make exceptions. So don't stress about the exception. Sometimes people do, and they really don't need to. But it's a little less clear in the case of Enoch, because it doesn't specifically use the word for heaven. But we do have these suggestions he was taken up, and certainly the understanding that he was taken to heaven was what people in the ancient world understood this to mean. In fact, there's a whole body of ancient literature known as the Enochic literature that's devoted to what happens to Enoch. And this literature is not in the Catholic Bible, but it very clearly indicates an early Jewish belief that Jesus, or that Enoch, was taken up to heaven, and he got a tour of heaven. According to this, he saw God's throne itself, and so that was very definitely how people interpreted this in former centuries.
All right.
What I don't understand is how someone could go into heaven before Christ dying. And
so the answer is, it's an exception. Like I said, God can make exceptions if he wants. Now, in terms of the mechanics of how that would happen, well, we know that people, and you can go back and listen to the podcast of the previous hour where I talked about this, God could forgive people even before Jesus died. Kind of like using a credit card. They were forgiven in anticipation of what Jesus would do. And in the same way, God can take people to heaven in anticipation of what Jesus would do, in the same way. So you could, if you want to think about it this way, you could say Enoch and Elijah went to heaven on credit, and eventually Jesus paid the price that would allow them to go to heaven, just like it's allowing everybody else to go to heaven who goes there.
All right. I hope that was helpful to you, Zach. We have to take a quick break, but we appreciate the call. I want to let you know, as I said before, just 2 days left in July, and all the July sales are going away. And it's hard to think of a more important one than we do in July than the Catholic Answers magazine sale. It's a great time to get your subscription. And a subscription is a great thing to get, especially if you've got anybody who maybe needs some shoring up of their trust in Catholic teaching in the home. Maybe they maybe just some who come by and visit. If you leave this magazine around, it's amazing what will happen when people just sit down and leaf through the pages. It's on sale right now. 1 year subscription, save 25% off the cover price, and that's $30 per year. We also include a free digital subscription and a free downloadable file with all the digital issues for the last 4 years. So you pay $30 for your 1 year subscription, you basically get that plus 4 years prior. If you do the 2 year subscription, it's $50, which means a 40% savings off the cover price. And then we also include the free digital subscription and a free downloadable file with all the digital issues for the last 8 years. So you pay for two and you get basically 10 years of magazine. You can do all of that at CatholicAnswersMagazine.com, but you've only got about 48 hours left to do that. CatholicAnswersMagazine.com.
Often unbelievers have a hard time reconciling the doctrine of hell with an all-good God. In fact, I've talked to Catholics who struggle with this. So what can we say to help? Well, first, the punishment of hell is not a kind of vengeance inflicted by God from without, but follows from the nature of sin. All those in hell choose it, and God's respect of man's free will doesn't contradict his goodness. Furthermore, it belongs to God's goodness to make a distinction between loyal and disloyal subjects, and to give their just deserts. What kind of a God would he be if he gave the same reward, heaven, to those who refuse to love him as to those who love him? He wouldn't be a good God. For these reasons, the doctrine of hell is not incompatible with God's goodness. I'm Carlo Broussard with a ready reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Hey Alexa, how many ways can I get EWTN?
You can get EWTN on television, via cable and satellite, on Apple TV, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Google Play. You can get EWTN radio in your car, on Sirius XM Channel 130, and on the go, on any mobile device with the EWTN app. And here's the best news. Now you can get EWTN's great programming on me.
Got to thank Erica Olson for coming in and answering the phones and doing all the call screening today, because Marie still on her honeymoon, or I guess maybe we'll get her back Monday. Are we supposed to get her back Monday, Nick? Yeah, we think so. We'll get her back Monday. Erica asking me at the break if I would promote the cruise. That's just a cruel joke on me, because you know we can't cruise and you know how bad I want to go. And come on, Erica.
I mean, come on. Like, who's sadder, you or me? Like,
that there's no cruise?
There's
I'm definitely
events.
Sadder.
I'm the events planner guy, and there's no events.
I guess so. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. There's no events.
How sad is that?
I know, really. There's no events. There was no. Are they giving you other work to do? Are you having?
Well, hello,
Are you having
I'm
to
the
sweep
new call
up?
Screener.
Oh, yes. I know you're also doing other work for Aline, I've noticed.
Yes, God bless Catholic Answers and everyone here
for
filling me with things to do.
Yeah. Well, we'll God willing, before too long, events will be back, and you'll be back in business.
Yes.
And
keep your ears open, people, because we are going to be back.
As everyone knows, events coordinators stress out about it and they drive everybody crazy with their worries and all that stuff. Erica is the exception to that rule. She is so relaxed and trusting, and she gets everything done in an orderly way. So I hope we will be back to cruising and having conferences and all that shortly, but we'll leave that in the hands of God. 888-318-7884, our number here. It's mean to tease me with a cruise, though, when it takes me a minute to remember the COVID. John in New Orleans, Louisiana, watching on YouTube, is next. Jimmy Akin is our guest, as you know, John. So your question for Jimmy.
Yes, I have a problem with purgatory, because it's unbiblical, and there are examples in the Bible, such as when Jesus told the people on the cross, "Today you will be with me in paradise." And then in the Gospel of Luke, the rich man and Lazarus, the rich man did not go to purgatory. And Jesus told his disciples, "Marvel not that the demons are subject to you, but be glad that your names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life." And in Revelation, at the great
Okay,
white...
John, you're throwing a lot of different things on the table there, and I want to be able to give you a good response. So we got to limit the number of things we're going to talk about, because I can only talk for a few minutes in response to any one given caller. If you have more things that you'd like to talk about, you know, additional objections you have to purgatory or passages that you think disprove it, then you can call again. And but I want to make sure that I'm able to give a reasonably, you know, reasonably substantial response to the different passages that you're mentioning. So in regard to the first one, well, the word purgatory is not in the Bible, but then there are a lot of terms that are not in the Bible that still reflect biblical realities, like the word original sin. That's not in the Bible. That's a post-biblical theological term, but the idea that the human race fell with Adam and Eve and that has implications for the rest of us, the doctrine of original sin, that's a biblical teaching, even though the word, the term original sin hadn't been coined yet. Same thing with the term Trinity. The word Trinity is a later doctrinal term, but it reflects a biblical reality. And the word Bible even is one of those, because the word Bible didn't exist when the Bible was being written. The Bible was not bound together as one book for a long time. That's why it has different books in it. So in terms of purgatory, the Catholic faith would hold that even though the term purgatory was not used in biblical times, it's another term like Trinity or Bible or original sin that reflects biblical principles. And if you want to read about some of those, you can go to Catholic.com, just type in the word purgatory. You'll get some articles that deal with the biblical basis for the principles that apply to purgatory. I'm not going to go through those now, because if I did, I wouldn't have time to address the various passages that you mentioned. But you mentioned, for example, the thief on the cross. Well, there are a number of reasons why the thief on the cross actually does not serve as a disproof for the idea of purgatory. One of them is the simple fact that Greek does not have punctuation. And what Jesus is saying to the thief is ambiguous when he says, I tell you, you will be with me in purgatory. He uses the word, you will be with me in paradise. He uses the word today, but it's unclear in the Greek what that's attached to. It could be that Jesus is saying, I tell you, you will be with me in purgatory, in paradise today, meaning that's when you're going to be there. Or it could be, I tell you today, you will be with me in paradise, emphasizing, I'm telling you right now, you're going to be with me in paradise. Both of those are possible in the Greek. And if Jesus meant the second one of those, it wouldn't mean that the guy was going to be in paradise that day. But let's suppose that is what it means, that the guy's going to be in paradise that day. And there are several other reasons I'm not even going to go into with this, just to keep it short. But the Catholic Church does not teach that purgatory takes time. In fact, if you read Pope Benedict's encyclical, Spes Salvi, on Christian hope, he says we can't measure purgatory in earthly time. And we have various passages like in 1 Corinthians 15:52, where it says that when Jesus comes back, we'll be transformed in the twinkling of an eye. Well, maybe that's how purgatory works. And so maybe the thief on the cross was transformed in the twinkling of an eye. He experienced his purification, which is what purgatory is. He experienced his purification all in a moment that you can't measure, as Pope Benedict said, in earthly time. And thus, he could be in paradise with Jesus that day. It doesn't contradict the idea of purgatory. When it comes to another passage that you mentioned, which was the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, well, actually, there's a bit of a debate about, is the rich man in hell or in purgatory? My thought, and I've written about this, is that he's in hell. So, yeah, I think you're right. The rich man is in hell. The rich man did not go to purgatory. But this is not an exhaustive account of what happens in the afterlife. And this is a parable. It is a limited, partially symbolic view of what happens in the afterlife. It doesn't cover all the details. And so even though this passage does not mention purgatory, that doesn't mean purgatory isn't real. We have other passages that imply, and here's one of them. You'll want to look it up. If you look in 1 Corinthians 3, Paul talks about how when we build on the foundation of Christ and we stand before God in judgment, our works are going to be tested. And he pictures us as like building a building on the foundation of Christ. We can build with good works, like which he compares to gold and silver and precious jewels, or we can build with bad works, which he compares to wood, hay, and straw. And he says, the building that we've made is going to be tested by God's fire. And if we have built poorly on the foundation of Jesus, if all we've got is wood, hay, and straw, that fire is going to burn up the building that we're in, and we're going to escape from it, and so we'll be saved, but it'll be like escaping through fire. And so he holds out the prospect of having this experience in the afterlife where we end up experiencing some negative consequences, even though we're saved. We experience some negative consequences in the afterlife on account of our sins in this life. And thus, we're freed from the effects of those sins so we can be saved and go to heaven. That's what purgatory is. So we do have Bible verses that talk about it, or at least the principles that are involved in it. And there are answers to objections that have been made based on various other passages. I was able to deal with a few of them. I know you have more. If you'd like, feel free to call in on another show, and I'll be happy to deal with others.
John, thank you very much. I hope that was helpful to you. Appreciate your call. 888-318-7884. The number line's just jammed right now, so we're going to keep moving. Stephen in Hummelstown, Pennsylvania. You are next. Hi, Stephen. You there with us?
Hello. Yeah, I'm here.
All right. Go ahead.
My question, I have a traditional version of the little office of the Blessed Virgin Mary, and I was looking at it, and I saw that some of the hours, the timing of them, like there's one that's at midnight, and then the one after that, I think, is either at 6 a.m. or at like the crack of dawn, or whenever dawn is happening. And I was just wondering, the monks who do that in like the divine office every day, do they only sleep 5 or 6 hours a night? Or do they like wake up in the middle of the night to do one of the hours? Like how do they do that? And how do they get normal sleep with that?
So monks have human natures just like the rest of us. They need just as much sleep as we do. And even if they don't necessarily get it all the time, they need to have the same, biologically, they need to have the same amount of sleep that we do. And so my understanding is what they do is they get up in the middle of the night. They say their office or whatever other spiritual activity they may have that they need to do. And then they go back to sleep. And to enable them to do that, monks actually ended up making a technological contribution to our civilization. Because originally, if you wanted to keep time at night, you needed to use something like candles. And you could, if you had a candle that would burn at a known rate, you could measure time based on how much of the candle is burned, and you could count how many hours had gone by. But that's not particularly convenient for waking up in the middle of the night, because candles don't wake you up, at least not unless they catch the house on fire, which you don't want. And so monks invented the water clock. And so instead of using a candle, what they found you could do is you could have a reservoir of water with a little bitty hole in it, and it would drip out water at a fixed rate, and as those drips added up, they could turn a crank, which would then engage some gears, and eventually, at a time that you specified, it would set off an alarm, so you could get up in the middle of the night and say your prayers as a monk. And so that's actually where we got some of the first alarm clocks. It was the invention of the water clocks, specifically so that monks could say their prayers in the middle of the night.
Steve?
Cool, huh?
All right. I'm going to just go with Steve is a very satisfied customer. Appreciate the call, Steve. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. 888-318-7884 is our number. Open forum means open to anybody. So anyone's welcome to call. It also means you can call with any question that you've got. Jimmy will do his best to get you a good, solid answer. I want to remind you again, Catholic Answers Magazine on sale for just 2 more days. Get your subscription at CatholicAnswersMagazine.com. 1 year subscription, just $30. 2 year subscription, just $50. And that lasts until the last day of this month, which is tomorrow, I think. All right, right back after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
We did it again. We've got great podcast episodes this week for you over at Catholic Answers Focus. Monday's episode is a joyful conversation with Father Hugh Barber about Christian joy. What is it and how can you get it? Then on Wednesday's episode, John DeRosa gives us helpful tips for dealing with the person who says belief in God is just wishful thinking or the opiate of the masses or a crutch for weak minds. You get the idea. Subscribe to Catholic Answers Focus on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts, or visit our website at CatholicAnswersFocus.com. Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
Every Catholic has heard the challenge. How can you believe that? Don't you know the Bible says? It's a challenge we have to meet. If we can't reconcile apparent contradictions between Scripture and Catholic teaching, how can our faith survive? And if we can't answer our Protestant brothers and sisters, how will they ever come to embrace the fullness of the faith? In Meeting the Protestant Challenge, apologist Carlo Broussard gives you the knowledge and tools you need to answer 50 of the most common Bible-based objections to Catholicism. Be prepared to give an answer. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Challenge today by calling 844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
I'm Gloria Purvis.
And I'm Deacon Harold. The Morning Glory team asks, could you give a gift that keeps on giving?
Tomorrow morning, 7 Eastern. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
There it is. Uh-huh. A little bit of groovy music. Thanks, Nick Chamberlain. Thanks for drumming in that, and then thanks for playing it every Thursday when Jimmy's here. 888-318-7884, our number. It's open forum. It's also Groovy Music Thursday, as you just found out. Up next is Millie in Dallas, Texas. Hang on, Millie. Okay, Millie, are you there with us?
Hi.
Hi, Millie. Your question, please.
Hi. I was wondering how we know, because we have like just so many evidence based off the Bible, how do we know that the Bible is the truth in our holy book?
Great question, Millie. Well, thank you.
So there's actually a lot to say about that, and there's more than I can say about it than I really have time for at the moment. But to give you a basic sketch, if we approach the Bible, and in particular the New Testament, because that's the period of history we have the most information about, and we start looking to say, well, how well does what we read in the New Testament match up against what we know about this period in history? It matches up very, very well. In fact, there was a historian a little more than 100 years ago who was taught to be skeptical, for example, of the value of the Book of Luke and the Book of Acts, which were written by the same guy. The Gospel of Luke and Acts were both written by Luke the physician. And he was taught to be skeptical of Luke and think, oh, this isn't real history. But he was a historian, and he decided to do an open-minded study of of Luke, and he said, I'm going to check out everything from history that I can, everything that Luke mentions. If I can find evidence for it or against it, I'm going to look for that and then see how accurate Luke really is. And he expected to find that Luke was not accurate at all. What he found was that Luke is amazingly accurate. There are all kinds of little details in both the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts that are dead on accurate and that could not have been faked. Because it's not like today. You couldn't go on the internet and look up, oh, what are the town officials in this city called? You know, you needed to like be there to know, oh, what do they call the head officials locally? And Luke is right on case after case after case. And he ended up writing a book where he presented the results of his study, and he concluded that Luke is a world-class historian that belongs to be put up there with the greatest historians outside of the Bible, that he's extremely careful, he's extremely faithful, and he's extremely accurate. And so by taking this kind of evidence-based approach, we can, and what do we know about history, and how do we, you know, how can we confirm various things in the Bible based on what we know from history outside of the Bible? We build a case for the overall reliability of the New Testament. And then once we realize we need to take it seriously, just as a historical document, we need to go further and say, okay, so we know it has this at least broad accuracy as a historical document. It's given us real history about Jesus and so forth. We need to take the miracle claims seriously. And when you start investigating the miracles of Jesus, and especially when you investigate the resurrection of Jesus, you find, hey, we've got really good evidence that Jesus was resurrected. The alternative theories to the resurrection all have problems. The understanding that best makes sense of the evidence we have is Jesus really did rise from the dead. And if so, that's a supernatural act. And that means that the Bible is not just something that has historical value, it's something that has spiritual value in addition to its historical value, and that gives us confidence to make a leap of faith and say, I can trust the Bible even when I can't prove particular things here or there from factors outside the Bible. If you'd like more information about all that, I deal with different aspects of that in my book, A Daily Defense, along with a bunch of other objections to the Christian faith. But that's a basic sketch of how I would argue for the Bible's trustworthiness. The foundation of it is showing that, yes, indeed, the New Testament is valuable just as a set of historical documents. And then once you examine the resurrection of Jesus, it turns out it's valuable also on a supernatural level that gives us even more confidence beyond what you could show from history alone.
Millie, I'd love to send you the book, A Daily Defense. Jimmy, I was also thinking maybe I could send her your DVD, Why You Can Trust the Gospels.
That would be great.
Yeah, because your questions sound so sincere, Millie, and I'd love you to have these resources. Does that sound all right?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Can you just hang on the line, and then Erica will get your information, and we'll send you these two. We'll send you A Daily Defense, the book, and then we'll send you the DVD, Why You Can Trust the Gospels. Really appreciate your call, Millie. Thank you so much. Call back as more questions might occur to you. We'd love to take your call again. 888-318-7884, the number here. Dan in Cincinnati, Ohio is next. Dan in Cincinnati, Ohio, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. I hope I have a good connection. My phone's a little dim, but I'm the guy who talked to you about donating to SQPN and inviting you to Cincinnati for Skyline Chili.
Nice to hear from you.
Yeah. Well, thanks. My question was going to be about the church's teaching on aliens, since I saw your Facebook page this morning about Jesus blessing the aliens. And then I realized it'd kind of be speculation. So I'd probably more like to know about the angels The only thing I know about the angels are the six choirs of angels and Mont Michel in France, where St. Michael the Archangel appeared, and then the Bible accounts of Raphael, Gabriel, and Michael. And Ludwig Ott, I don't know if you've ever heard of Ludwig Ott.
Oh, yes.
He's got a little quote about the angels.
What would you like to know about them?
Well, I know there's six choirs of them, and it also it says myriads of them, so I don't know how much a myriad is. And well, I think I know basically what their station is, or whatever you want to call it, with the archangels and the guardian angels and that.
Okay, let me. We've got a number of issues on the table here, so let me see what I can do to be of assistance. So, in terms of aliens, the church doesn't have a teaching on aliens. There may or may not be aliens. It's just a question of, did God choose to create intelligent life elsewhere? Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. We don't know. What we do know is, if he did, well, then they're like us. They're creatures of God, and so presumably he would have some kind of relationship with them. It might or might not be like our relationship with him. But since you mentioned Mysterious World, I'll mention that I actually did an episode on this exact topic a while back. So you can go back into the archives, look up episode 55. And 55 is all devoted to the subject of aliens and theology and the Christian faith and what would it all mean if there was intelligent life out there. And so check out episode 55. In terms of angels, actually there are different numbers of orders or choirs of angels that have been proposed. You'll hear different numbers. Sometimes you'll hear seven, sometimes you'll hear nine. And John Paul II pointed out that the church has never given a definitive list of the angelic hierarchy. So that's an area where people can speculate about exactly how many different kinds of angels are there, exactly how are they ranked, how do they relate to each other. That's something that we don't know for sure. We know there are certain types of angels that we read about, but God hasn't given us a complete detailed description of the angelic world. In terms of myriads, a myriad is 10,000. So when you read about there being myriads of myriads, that's 10,000 times 10,000, or hundreds of millions. And it's not surprising that there would be that many angels, because there are more than that number of humans. I mean, currently we're at 7 billion humans that are alive. And so, you know, there could be billions or trillions or quadrillions of angels. They didn't have words for that in Greek. And so once they got above 10,000, they would just say something like myriads of myriads, meaning just an uncountably huge number. In terms of a little bit more information about angels and how God's court in heaven works, you're in luck, because there is another episode of Mysterious World coming up. It's going to be the first Friday in August, and it's on God and the gods. So I talk about the biblical idea about God and his heavenly hierarchy and how the different kinds of angels work in that hierarchy and what the Bible has to say about that. So it won't be out until the first Friday in August, but check it out. Mysterious World episode on God and the gods, and it's going to go into the angelic hierarchy that God has.
And the first Friday of August is coming right up. So, Dan, perfect timing on that. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Are you going to address that kind of royal we that is in the beginning of the book of Genesis? In that?
I don't in this episode, but I will be in other episodes.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think that I heard you explain that once, that one possible way of understanding that is it's referring to a kind of royal court that...
Yes, and that's sometimes called a cohortative we, where it's like, let's us as a cohort do this. But it doesn't mean, or an associative we, but it doesn't mean other people are going to be involved. If I'm going to, let's say we're deciding what we're going to eat, and I'm going to pay for it, I could say, let's get pizza, even though I'm the one doing the work, I'm the one paying for the pizza. I'm associating you with that decision. And so when God says, let us make man in our image, he's like maybe talking to the angelic hierarchy, but he's the one that's going to do the work, because it makes it clear, you keep reading, God is the one that makes not the angels.
All right. I'm looking forward to that one. I am looking forward to that one. 888-318-7884, our number here. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's open forum. Oh, we've still got that free MP3 from Jimmy Akin. And this is another thing that you can't get anymore for free after this month ends tomorrow. So go to shop.catholic.com. It's a free MP3 on the book of Revelation called Understanding Revelation. Just look for where it says Understanding Revelation, click, and you'll get your free MP3 over at shop.catholic.com.
Your questions, Catholic Answers, live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
St. Hildegard of Bingen was a mystic, an abbess, a botanist, a saint, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Hildegard had her first visions at the age of 3, which she called the shade of the living light. She later wrote about them in works declared by St. Bernard of Clairvaux to be from God. Pope Benedict XVI agreed when he named her only one of 4 Doctors of the Church who are women in 2012.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
St. Paul's street evangelization isn't like other evangelism you might have seen on the streets. We don't yell, and we don't force anyone to pay attention to us. Instead, St. Paul's street evangelization is committed to presenting a positive, passionately Catholic presence to a world hungry for truth. For more information, or to start a chapter of your own, go to www.streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com. It's time to do our part.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open forum today. Jimmy Akin, our guest. That's really more fun than you should be allowed to have for 2 hours, but I get to have it, and so do you if you join us. Up next is Aaron in Houston, Texas, who's watching on Facebook. Aaron, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi.
Hi, Aaron.
I wanted to ask about the morality of purchasing something that includes both good and bad elements. So, like, my main example is, like, a gym membership. If it also includes, like, spiritual yoga classes and Tai Chi that you don't intend to partake in, you just want to go to the gym.
Okay, well, that's like buying anything. Anything that's made by human beings is going to have some problematic content in it from one time to another, whether it's a subscription to a TV channel or a cable network or the internet or a gym or whatever it may be, or even just buying a book, you know. It's a matter of prudence. You have to look at the amount of problematic content and make a prudential judgment. Is it so much problematic content that it would be better for me to use my money on something else that has less problematic content in it? There's no single answer to that. In most cases, you know, if you're not participating in it, in the problematic stuff, and if it's not a major part of, you know, what's going on there, and you will derive benefit from the good parts of it, then it's perfectly fine to go ahead. We don't have to withdraw from the world, which is what you'd have to do if you said, oh, if I ever encounter problematic content in something, I'm going to run away from it. Well, then you'd have to run away from everybody, because everybody is a sinner, and you're going to encounter problematic content from everybody at some point. And so it's really a prudential judgment, and you don't need to be scrupulous about it. If you're not involved in the problematic stuff and it's not a huge chunk of what's going on, then you can subscribe and say, I'm just not going to use that part.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very, very much. Thanks for holding on there, Aaron. I know we made you wait a long time today. Taylor in Indianapolis is next watching on YouTube. Taylor, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, Jimmy. So, as a new Catholic coming into the church, you know, this past month,
I've been really trying to be the best Catholic I can be. And part of that is, you know, reading papal documents. And I came across Pope Pius X's document on modernism. And I got kind of confused. So I was wondering if you could explain modernism and as well as, like, kind of how to prevent it in our daily lives.
Okay. Well, so modernism was a movement that got a lot of attention about 100 years ago, and it challenged a variety of different ideas in the Catholic world. And so there were documents that were written against it. There was also, for a time, there was what was called the anti-modernist oath that various Catholics were required to take upon assuming office. You know, like if you're going to be a pastor or something or a seminary professor, you would have to take the anti-modernist oath. Basically, modernism doesn't involve a single claim. There were a bunch of different claims that were advocated by modernists, and they all had to do kind of loosely with the idea of we need to update our presentation of the faith for the modern world. And that's not itself a problem to say we need to present the gospel in a way that people of a given time will understand it. That's just good evangelization. The problem is if you're denying essential elements of the Catholic faith as part of that, that's when it's a problem, because then you're not just presenting the faith in a way that people will respond to, you're actually tampering with the content of the faith. And so modernists made a bunch of proposals, and some of them were clearly contrary to the Catholic faith. Others were not as clearly opposed to it. And so it took a while, and this happened over the course of the 20th century, to sort out those ideas. And so you'll find some early documents that are written, you know, to address the ideas as they were being expressed in their time. And one of the things that's been pointed out with some of these older documents is, like, there's a famous one called the Syllabus of Errors, which is a section of short propositions that are being condemned. And in order to understand those propositions, you have to, like, go read other documents where they're talked about. And if you don't do that, you'll misunderstand what some of these things are saying. So it can be, you have to be kind of careful when you're reading the early anti-modernist literature, because it's easy to take some of it out of context. Over the course of time, the church has had the ability, the opportunity under God's guidance to evaluate some of the ideas that were being proposed by modernists. And, you know, things are almost never all good or all bad. They're usually somewhere in the middle. And some of the ideas modernists were talking about actually are not problematic, and the church has later ruled that some of these are not problematic, but others were. And so you have to be careful. You have to take things on a case-by-case basis, and you have to not be quick to either embrace or condemn something without looking at what is the church said, having had the opportunity to study this in more detail. The book that I would recommend for you is a book that I wrote called Teaching with Authority. And this is a book about the magisterium of the church and how it teaches and how to read church documents, how to interpret them correctly, how to look at doctrinal development and figure out, you know, is this legitimate or is it not? And it also talks about some of the early anti-modernist documents and what their current status is. And since you mentioned, Taylor, that you're brand new to the Catholic Church, as a confirmation present, I'd like to see if we can send you a free copy of Teaching with Authority.
Well, let's do it. Taylor, can you hang on a minute and we'll get your address and we'll send you the book?
Absolutely. I appreciate that so much. Thank you, Jimmy.
No problem.
Well, thank you, Taylor. Appreciate that. Just hang on and Erica will get your information and then we'll send you the book. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Matthew, way down in Kokomo, Indiana, next, watching on YouTube. Matthew, your question for Jimmy. Hang on, Matthew. Hang on one second. I messed up. It's getting late in the day. I don't know what I did there, Matthew. Go ahead. Your question for Jimmy.
Okay, so Me and many of my Catholic friends have a question about Unitism and Eastern Rite Catholics.
Okay.
We've attended one Eastern Rite Catholic Church, and we've been looking into it. And it seems that Eastern Rite Catholic churches accept totally different theology. They accept Eastern theology, essentially. And they venerate Eastern saints like Gregory Palamas, who are condemned as heretics by the Catholic Church. And we are wondering how this squares with the Catholicity of the Church, or whether or not this violates the consistency of the Catholic Church.
Okay. Well, so the Catholic Church is not the Borg. And so we don't all have to have exactly the same views on everything. There is a legitimate diversity. There's room for a legitimate diversity of opinion and a legitimate diversity of styles and emphases. And for the most part, there's not a problem between Eastern and Western Catholicism. The ultimate decider of is something outside the bounds of legitimate diversity, is it outside the bounds or is it acceptable? The ultimate decider of that is the Pope. And the popes historically have decided that it's legitimate to have diversity of opinions on various questions. So you don't have to say, well, you must believe every single thing that is commonly believed in the West. Not every theological question has been settled. And so even though certain ideas theologically are common in the West, the Church has not said this is infallibly the case. In fact, the Church has allowed a difference of opinion on some of them. And so even though an idea may be traditional in the West, that doesn't mean everybody has to accept it, because the popes have determined there's a legitimate diversity of opinion on this question. It has not yet been settled. In terms of practices like liturgical styles, there's room for diversity of liturgical styles as well. They're also, even if people were outside of communion at the time, and we should be careful about the word heresy because it tends not to apply to Eastern Christians historically. But the more appropriate term in most cases would be a state of schism exists. But even though individuals may not have been in full communion with the Catholic Church when they were alive, the popes have ruled that, you know, it's possible for people to be saved in such situations, and it's thus possible that they're in heaven, and it's thus possible in principle to venerate them. And for purposes of fostering devotion, the Catholic Church has not challenged the canonizations of saints that were outside of communion, but presumably in good conscience when they were alive. And in fact, some of them, like Gregory of Narek, are doctors of the Church today. And it's the popes who have declared them to be so, even though Gregory of Narek, for example, I know you mentioned Gregory Palamas, but I'm more familiar with the case of Gregory of Narek, was not in full communion with the Church at the time, but he lived a saintly life. He was apparently in good conscience. He was canonized in Eastern traditions, and he's accepted as a saint by and a doctor of the Church by popes today.
Thanks, Matthew. Appreciate the call. Sorry we weren't able to get to everybody. Jimmy Akin, thank you again for two very fine hours. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Anytime.
We gave away, you know what, we never gave away the Bible as a Catholic book today, but we gave away Teaching with Authority and A Daily Defense. Jimmy, you got tomorrow's coming out, Weird Questions, because it's
Weird Questions, fifth. Yeah.
And then on the first Friday in August, it will be
God and the Gods.
God and the Gods, oh yeah.
A discussion of God's heavenly angelic hierarchy.
I'm looking forward to that one. All right, tomorrow it's going to be open forum for non-Catholics. 2 hours of open forum for non-Catholics. Those are always fun hours. I hope you will join them for us right here on Catholic Answers Live.